Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. Funny how that works. Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, we are talking about taste. Why? Because it really does matter. And that's not just a name. We actually think that taste might be one of the keys to unlocking a lot of decisions for that would help us get to a better food system, certainly to improve the way our food tastes, but also much more profoundly. And that's true not just on a local level, but on a global level. And today we're going to be talking about taste in some sense on a global level with the editor of Restaurant Magazine from London, a wonderful, actually a really interesting trade magazine about the goings-on in London, but also what's happening with chefs around the world, with the editor William Drew. Thank you for joining us here in Bushwick.
Pleasure to be here.
And Restaurant Magazine is perhaps better known, in fact, as here in the U.S. and certainly in countries around the world, as the administering body of a program called the World's 50 Best Restaurants, which has got to be the hottest ticket in town. The 50 best, actually, well, the 100 best restaurants in the world are rated every year at a ceremony coming up in the end of April. You happen to be here from London, eating your way around some of the restaurants, maybe?
Yeah, just trying to eat as much as possible throughout New York. I still need to be here for a year or so to get a proper sample.
But I've been here 22 and I still can't keep up. And today we're going to talk about this idea of I think global food trends, but also how you rate restaurants around the world and what trends mean from one very distinct food culture like the United States to others, France, Italy, when we're talking about rating restaurants and comparing them in the world. If you have any questions about that program, about the restaurant scene in London or about how restaurants are viewed from a sort of global perspective, give us a call today at 718-417-2128 or send us an email at info@heritageradionetwork.com. If you are listening to a podcast, you can also tweet us at Taste Matters HRN and we'll answer your questions on a future episode. So welcome. Tell us a little bit about the history and the evolution of the World's 50 Best, because I think it might be new to some of our listeners here, although it's been going on for quite a while.
Sure. We're actually about to celebrate our 10th anniversary this year. So 10 years ago, the Restaurant Magazine ran a feature within the magazine, and it was a kind of informal poll, industry poll of a number of chefs and restaurateurs and food writers and critics. It was just a small feature within the magazine, and it grew from there. And over the last 10 years, it's grown phenomenally into a huge global event. The actual event itself takes place in London in April, 500 or so people. But most crucially, all the chefs from those restaurants rated come to London for the event, and it turns into a great celebration of gastronomy, a very much an industry celebration. And it, as it was conceived and still is, an industry poll, an industry event, although consumers obviously do take notice of who's in that top 50.
Of course, and I know people who actually carry the little card around with the list and try to check it off year to year.
Sure.
So let's talk a little bit. So it grew out of this sort of a poll, an informal survey. Let's talk about how it happens today.
It's effectively moved from being an informal poll to a much more structured system as it's grown. We now have 837 voters around the world. They're split into 27 different regions. Each region has a chairperson, and that chairperson helps appoint a panel of 30 voters. Those voters are made up of chefs and restaurateurs and food writers and gourmands and gastronomes, people that travel the world regularly eating in some great restaurants. They all have 7 votes, four of which are within their own region, 3 from another region outside of their own. So the idea is we get a snapshot that year of what's going on, current tastes at the top end of the restaurant world. The list obviously changes, and it changes as tastes change. But a lot of restaurants are consistently in the top 50.
So we'll get to some of those. In the interest of full disclosure, you nodded to me as you said that because I should let everyone know that I am the chair of the Eastern United States region. So the U.S. is divided into three regions, and that comprises three of the 27 regions that the world is divided into for this program. For the 10 years that it's gone on, have you seen any differences in sort of the restaurants that emerge or the styles of cooking, or do you have any insight into what snapshots you've been taking?
Sure. I mean, I think undoubtedly gastronomy has changed over the last 10 years. The biggest overall change in that decade, I would say, would be the move away from classic I hesitate to say French, but French style restaurants, classical French style.
Meaning tablecloths and fancy silver and all that kind of stuff.
What would have been termed classical fine dining, I suppose, is still, it's still relevant. It's not that it's disappeared, but there are many other styles of restaurant that have made it onto the list and even to the very top of the list. In the form of Noma in Copenhagen, which, although it's extremely kind of high-end, it's bare wooden floors, wooden tables, no tablecloths. The service style is very relaxed. The chefs come out and serve food. The waiters may be in jeans and so on and so forth. So we have a real spread in every year, a real spread of styles of restaurant in the 50 from what might be termed very classic, very formal restaurants to extremely informal walk-in restaurants.
So given that range, and it's funny to talk about, we're sitting here in a shipping container attached to a restaurant in Brooklyn of some renown, looking out on a wooden, it's not even a wood floor, it's a corrugated or whatever that stainless steel is. What links them on the list? I mean, obviously people think that they're great restaurants, but something must hold them together to put a restaurant by Alain Ducasse on the same list as one by Iñaki Azpilicueta or whatever, however you pronounce it.
Sure.
Azpilicueta.
Good effort. I guess, I mean, on a very simplistic level, of course, what links them is the fact that people think they're great. Now, I know that sounds a bit obvious, but it is simply a computation of all those votes. I guess we can speculate because we don't know exactly why people vote for those. But what we do say is there are no criteria in your voting or in what you vote for, except for the fact that you have to have been to the restaurant within the 18 months prior to voting, and it has to be your best restaurant experience of any kind. So it's the overall experience. So we don't say the food is more important than the service or the decor or the vibe or the atmosphere. We don't say one thing is more important or of equal importance. It's entirely subjective for each individual voter. But I suppose what links them is the overall experience, and that overall experience is usually innovative to some degree, and it has to be vibrant and exciting. And whether that's exciting in terms of on your taste buds, or exciting in terms of the atmosphere that it creates, or both, ideally both, then that would kind of help propel you onto the list.
Interesting. I love, as someone who's obsessed with, I would say, the role that media plays in food culture and in the development of taste, I love the idea that these are places, it's almost like a meta conversation. These are places that people think are the best. And not just any people, as you said, it's a group of people that's comprised of chefs and journalists and people who are eating around the world probably more than a lot of others. Although in New York, that's always a weird thing, because in New York and in some other food cities, more regular people eat out more than food people do often, because breakfast, lunch, and dinner adds up to 24 meals a day, and many people don't have kitchens here. However, let's talk about the impact that you think that the list itself has had on restaurants, because I think some people we're new to it here in the U.S. The Beard Foundation, obviously where I work, has had our awards. It's actually our 22nd year, and those are similarly about they're not similar. They're about an industry. They're voted on by members, peers, members of the chef community and members of the food community and the food journalists, for chefs and mostly for food, and not so much exactly for restaurants, but for the chefs, which has always been our focus. But World's 50 Best is a little new to us, and in some other places it's been tremendously popular for since it began, London being one of them. What can Americans learn from having their restaurants be sort of in this group, or what does it mean to be... first of all, what American restaurants do you know are on the list?
Well, last year, the American restaurants on the list were, I guess, the new ones to start with. Danielle.
Okay.
Momofuku Sambar, so David Chang.
So there's a huge difference.
Immediately,
yes,
you get
low,
the sense of the different styles of restaurant. 11 Madison Park, Le Bernardin, and Per Se, of course.
And Alinea, I think.
And then out of New York, yeah, okay. Alinea, and I think that might
French
be
Laundry.
It. French no. Laundry has been on the list for the majority of the 10 years, and is a previous winner. In the early days of the list. Was the number one.
Oh.
There have only been, in the 9 years prior to this year, there have been four winners. So the French Laundry in the early days, the Fat Duck in Bray near London, El Bui, of course, for many years from Spain, and then for the last 2 years, Noma in Copenhagen.
Wow, so 10 years and only four people have held the top spot. Okay, that's interesting.
In nine, actually.
So when it's, I mean, we earlier this morning I was having a conversation about the changes, the Beard Foundation celebrating its 25th anniversary and the changes that have happened in the U.S. in the food world and also around the world. And we wondered if James Beard could have imagined that a restaurant in the U.S. would have been on the top, in the list of the top 50 restaurants in the world. And there you mentioned, I think, six of them. Mm-hmm. So what do you think... How are we to take that? well, in the colonies over here.
Yeah. I mean, I think undoubtedly the U.S. has a hugely strong food culture, and it's noticeable. I mean, one that I know this already, but it's noticeable being here the last few days that it crosses all boundaries. So it's very reflective of the list as a whole, in a sense, in that there are a lot of great restaurants that aren't formal. As you mentioned earlier, we're in one here which has a great reputation amongst chefs. Mm-hmm. Momofuku Sambar, David Chang's kind of Korean-American mm-hmm. concept is the classic example of a restaurant which wouldn't tick the boxes of more traditional guides.
Right. Not going to have three Michelin stars. I can say that. You can't say that.
It's not going to have three Michelin stars, and yet it has been consistently in the top 50 in the last few years. I think going back to your earlier question about what can American restaurants kind of learn from or learn about being on the list, it's an affirmation rather than an end goal. So it's mm-hmm. an affirmation of what you're doing and the fact that your peer group respects what you're doing. But the reality is it's also an extremely effective business tool.
Uh-huh.
So as soon as you get onto the list, that pretty much always means you are now going to be full.
Really?
From the next day.
Wow.
So I don't have the stats to hand on when Noma became the number one, but it had something, it could have filled the restaurant for 15 years, the amount of inquiries it had, I think, over the following few days after it first became number one. Now, obviously, that's an extreme example because it was the number one on the list.
Right.
And a lot of people outside the industry didn't know about it.
Didn't know about it. Number one in a country people don't think of first about food necessarily,
sure.
Certainly for design and so a lot of other wonderful things in Denmark, but certainly put Denmark on the map as a place of food.
Absolutely. And it has that power as well in that one restaurant can lead a whole regional culinary revival, a whole tourist kind of upsurge
sure.
for the gastronomic tourists.
And that actually leads me to another question, because I think actually the Danish government has noticed or was aware and ready to act on the success of Noma and to use it almost in a more global economic trade way, in ways that it's hard to imagine, when the French Laundry was number one, that the Obama administration, for instance, would celebrate that and, you know, send emissaries, gastronomic emissaries around the world the way sure. that Denmark has done. And so how do politics play, or are they consequence rather than a player in the list?
I think they're a consequence. I mean, undoubtedly the great success of Spanish restaurants in recent years, led by El Bui, but There are a lot of last year there were I think three Spanish restaurants in the top 10.
Wow.
Certainly those at number 2 and 3 on the list, which were El Cela de Can Roca in Girona and Mugaritz in San Sebastian. The Spanish Tourist Board has been very active over the years in terms of promoting Spain as a culinary destination, and obviously has other attractions too to go into Spain for the weather and the culture and so on. But the food culture is seen as an intrinsic part of the appeal. And I think that's something that you know, food is obviously an inherent part of any culture. And if you can draw people in through your restaurants, whether they be kind of expensive restaurants or mid-scale restaurants, then that's got to be a useful tool. I mean, New York being an extraordinary example of having the most amazing array of mid-level in terms of price restaurants in one concentrated space.
Right, you could walk between all of them.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so when we come back from this break, actually, I think we're going to ask you where you've been eating, and then we're going to talk a little bit about your magazine background, because I think you might have some interesting... I'm curious to hear... You're not from the food world, and I'm curious to hear your perceptions of it now being so immersed in this important project.
Sure.
Struck Romeo, sing the streets a serenade, laying everybody low with a love song that he made. Find the streetlight, steps out of the shade, says something like, "You and me, babe, how about it?" Juliet says, "Hey, it's Romeo, you nearly give me a heart attack." He's underneath the window, she's singing, "My boyfriend's back. You shouldn't come around here singing up at people like that. Anyway, what you gonna do about it?" Juliet, the dice was loaded from the start, and I bet, and you exploded into my heart. And I forget the movie song. When you're gonna realize it was just that the time was wrong, Juliet. Come up on different streets.
Whole Foods Market creates win-win partnerships with our suppliers, and we love to tell their stories. Hot Bread Kitchen is a nonprofit, multi-ethnic bakery and job training program out of Manhattan, whose range of international breads are as impressive as they are authentic. Learn more at hotbreadkitchen.org or visit one of our 6 Manhattan locations for a taste.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. We're talking with William Drew, who's the editor of London's Restaurant Magazine, a really wonderful trade magazine. When it comes to our office, we all pour over it. Of course, it's the Beard Foundation. We want to know what's happening there. But I think you have a really great, for a trade, it takes a minute to realize it's a trade magazine, honestly, which for us here is a compliment, because ours are kind of ugly and boring and you know, they get the point across. But you come from a magazine background, is that correct?
Not, I do, yeah. I've worked in trade magazines before, but I've also worked in consumer magazines, and not in the food arena. So I worked on various lifestyle magazines over the years, and I guess that certainly informed the way I approach a business-to-business magazine, a trade magazine, because I believe that you're still producing something for readers who want to be stimulated and interested. It's not just about getting across information in a kind of functional way. You want even when you're reading it for work purposes,
right,
as it were, you want it to look great. You want access points. You want great pictures. You want to feel much more. You know, it's a visual medium, and it's a creative industry we're working in. So people respond to a more creative and stimulating magazine, I hope.
Well, I think you do a really great job, and you make the London restaurant scene seem really exciting. What's happening there?
Thank you. Although I have to say, not just London, the whole of the UK.
Okay, sorry, pardon me.
Very, very important. Yes. We don't restrict it just to London. Although, of course, London leads the UK restaurant scene inevitably, and there's the greatest concentration of restaurants.
Right, but people are schlepping out to the Sportsman.
The Sportsman, which is a pub out in the Kent Estuary, on the Thames Estuary in Kent. People are making trips up to Nottingham to see Sat Baines' restaurant, which is worth seeing, and all the way up north to the Lake District, where a guy called Simon Rogan has a great restaurant called L'Enclume. So there are some brilliant restaurants, of course, all over the UK.
But
what's happening in the UK scene, I guess it's some ways reflective of global trends, in that there is a great casualization of dining, much more democratic, much more accessible. But I think also importantly, there is a return to the top of the agenda of taste and flavor. So perhaps in recent years that's been overtaken sometimes by maybe worthiness or provenance of where the food is coming from, or sometimes trickery and theatre. All of those things can be important and still play a role. But it seems to us that taste and flavour is back at the top of the agenda for chefs and restaurants, and that's where it should be.
Oh, great. Well, here. I'll remind our listeners that you can call in at 718-497-2128 or write us questions at info@heritageradionetwork.com. Where have you eaten here in New York? I know you're just here for a short time.
Yeah, unfortunately, I haven't had enough time, but I was privileged to eat at 11 Madison Park last night. I've also...
Which last year was on the list at number, do you know?
It was number 24 last year, and a big riser. It was number 50 the year before, so they're obviously doing something right. I think the guys there... What's interesting about that restaurant for me is the collaboration between the front of house and back of house. They think everything through very carefully, and it's not...
In fact, they bring you to the back of the house at some point.
They bring you to the back of the house. Yeah, you bring you into the kitchen for one course, a cocktail, effectively, which is great fun. There's elements of theatre, but it's not done in too over-the-top fashion. It's a very relaxed service style and a really buzzing restaurant, especially considering it does have 3 Michelin stars, so it is the top of that particular kind of classic tree, as it were. But it's very relaxed feel with really original, inventive food. But they have a great philosophy, I think, of working together, front of house and back of house, and not one doesn't overtake the other.
Right, which you mentioned also at Noma is one of the interesting experiences there. It's almost disarming and lovely that the cooks come out and present the food in their kitchen garb in a very unaffected, unrehearsed way, which is nice. So there's, and we also have seen a rise, and certainly, in fact, in the next few months, more of this will be happening, where the almost Japanese style of eating across from the chef in the kitchen, like at Momofuku Ko or Brooklyn Fair, has taken place here. That's further broken down, literally, the wall between the back of house and front of house, and different from what we saw 15 years ago with a chef's table, which was actually a table set up in the kitchen through that wall, but now there's a permeability between the two.
And it's the extension of the phenomenon of the open kitchen, whereas rather than having a window onto that world and you kind of looking into that separate world, you're very much part of it. So I guess it's getting closer to, you know, if you go around and eat in your friend's house and, you know, they're cooking in the kitchen and you're eating right there. And that's the kind of, I guess, the vibe they want to get across, that you're part of this. This is not a separate world, a separate mysterious world behind the closed walls. But it's great. It also gets chefs, you know, interacting with customers, which has not always been the case in the past.
No, and you haven't always wanted to see that or be part of that interaction. But I think that's good also overall for the experience of people in the kitchen as well as people in the dining room.
Sure.
So we have an interesting question following up on something that you said earlier from one of our listeners, who recalls that you mentioned that restaurants are full as soon as they're on the list, or at least that's the experience of most. And the question is, what is the temporal relationship between the list and taste? Is it that restaurants are moving the idea of taste forward and then they emerge? Or do you think people are actually trying to get on the list by innovating or changing or doing...
I think, like all these things, it's very dangerous to try actively to get on the list.
Yes.
You've got to, first and foremost, please your customers and be true to yourself of what you want to produce, the food you want to produce, the type of restaurant you want to create. If you go chasing, just in the same way that if you go chasing Michelin stars, it's a dangerous route to go down.
Yes, you get yourself in a lot of debt, and it doesn't always pay off.
However, I would say that a lot of the restaurants on the list, because they're very special and very unique, they tend to have people behind them who have a real passion and a real vision. And sometimes that vision takes some time. It's maybe ahead of the game. It's maybe ahead of its time. So sometimes it takes time for consumers to catch up. Mm-hmm. And that's sometimes where the list can have a great effect, because you can be a hugely respected restaurant amongst your peers and amongst the kind of gastronomic community, but you may not be that well known outside it because you're doing something quite unique, quite new, maybe a little bit avant-garde. Mm-hmm. If you then come onto the list, then more people will be exposed to that.
But they'll know where it's...
Yeah, they'll experiment with it. They'll give it a try. It gives them a reason to try it. And of course, you then still have to deliver in order for people to keep coming back and to be full.
Right.
But it can help just in terms of global exposure and worldwide exposure.
Of course. And I've had the personal experience. You look at the list and like, wow, interesting. I don't know that. And then suddenly you want to know that, because obviously at least some people somewhere think it's worth knowing. And that's a really important piece.
For sure. And we certainly have been, we're happy that in recent years the list has become much more genuinely global. So we have a stronger presence in Asia, Japan, Hong Kong. Last year we had the first restaurant from Russia on the list, the first restaurant from Peru on the list. We have a number from Mexico, others from South America, others from South Africa. So there is a genuine kind of global spread. It's still, you know, it's still Europe-centric, Europe plus the US, I guess, dominating it. And they have kind of led contemporary cuisine, mm-hmm. As we know. And we're obviously based in London, but we are trying to become more genuinely global all the time.
That's great. I think that is perhaps one of the most important services the list can offer, is to get us out of our Eurocentric minds. Even here in America, although we feel like we've broken free from, I don't know, the French kitchen, so to speak, or even the Spanish kitchen, but there's such an exchange now with social media, with blogs and Facebook and just Twitter, that you see things around the world. A chef who doesn't know what's happening around the world is underinformed, I think, in some serious way.
And one of the things that the chefs tell us that they love about the world's 50 best is that they get the chance to come to London and get together. And it's all very well, you know, they're Skyping or texting or tweeting each other, but actually physically getting together for a couple of days, making plans to collaborate over the coming year, comparing notes, going out to eat together. That's a really important part of the program.
And we sometimes forget, I think, that chefs spend most of their time in kitchens cooking. You know, that part of breaking down that wall also gets them to interact in a way that you don't always have the opportunity. When I was young and in hotel school, I had a professor who used to literally, just for friends, go eat around Europe and bring back menus to give to chefs because they couldn't get out. And so all these opportunities to bring them together to exchange ideas and just to have fun, which I think everyone does in London.
Absolutely. And you know, obviously it gives them a chance to travel some more. If they're traveling over from the US, they may go to other cities in Europe, or if they're traveling from Asia, they may do something similar. So it gets them, yeah, as you say, they're out and about and looking up from the past.
Right. In the last few minutes, I'd like to talk a little bit about the logistics of the program, because we are asked about it a lot, and so people know it as the San Pellegrino list of the world's 50 best.
Yeah, it's the list is this year actually called the world's 50 best restaurants, sponsored by San Pellegrino and Acquapanna, and we so the slight change in the name, because it was called the San Pellegrino World's 50 Best Restaurants. What we wanted to both our associates at San Pellegrino and ourselves at Restaurant Magazine, who organized the list, what we wanted to clarify is that San Pellegrino and Acquapanna are the sponsor, right, not the organizer. They have no influence on the makeup of the list whatsoever, and you certainly don't have to, for example, stock a certain type of water to be on the list, which is right, something that people frequently think is the case. You certainly don't have to be a certain style of restaurant. There are no criteria, as I said before, other than just being a great restaurant that the voter likes. So we wanted to clarify that on from both parties. So hopefully that will mm-hmm. Be the case. But yes, it has become known over the years as a San Pellegrino list. Mm-hmm. We hope to continue to work with those sponsors for many years to come.
They are sponsors of some of our Beard Foundation programs, so we understand that. And they happen to be present in a lot of places where you want to eat.
Sure. I think it's been a great mutually beneficial relationship. They've established themselves as the kind of fine dining water brand of choice.
Even as some restaurants are moving away at the same time and doing local things and trying to make environmentally based decisions. One last thing, I'm sorry to squish it into the minutes, but in the last minutes we have, there was a Times piece about the program last year when the awards came out, and everyone wants to know about the lobbying in the countries that fly people over and all those sorts of things. And do you have a perspective on that from where you sit?
Sure. What we ask is that we ask all our voters to retain their integrity. As part of their jobs, some of them will get taken to restaurants around the world, and that's fine. We're not going to stop that. We trust them. We trust that they, when they go to a restaurant, maybe they've been invited and they're getting a free meal, but that does not mean that restaurant is suddenly going to be brilliant. So it may give them the opportunity to go to those restaurants, but that restaurant still has to deliver. And bearing in mind, most of the voters go to a huge number of restaurants during the year, yes. And they only have 7 votes, and they only have 3 outside of their country. So we ask our chairs around the world to kind of monitor who is doing what, and try and keep an eye out for any untoward activity. It's not a perfect system. We can't ever claim that it's 100% perfect, and there won't be small anomalies. But overall, we're confident that it has integrity as a list. It has integrity as an overall snapshot of what's going on in the gastronomic world as a whole.
Okay, and I'll just take one more moment on that point and ask, if you're a chef and you're or someone in a restaurant and someone sits down and starts the conversation by saying, "I'm a voter for the world's 50 best," what have you got? What can that person do?
Well, that person wouldn't be a voter for very long, because they are not allowed to publicise the fact that they're voting on the list.
Okay.
So as part of their agreement to vote, they're not meant to tell anybody. Right. We don't publicise who votes until after the event. The only people who we know voters are the 31 chairs around the world.
Okay, well, if you can find out the complete list and some archival lists, are they all available on the website?
Yeah, they are.
So it's theworlds50best.com, is that correct?
That is correct.
So you should all go there and see which ones you've been to and which ones you want to go to, and stay tuned for April 30th when you'll find out this year's list of the world's 50 best restaurants. Thanks for being with us, William Drew from Restaurant Magazine. Next week, we are welcoming Barb Stuckey for a very different conversation about taste. She's one of the world leading experts in developing food products for large and small companies from California, who has a great new book called Taste, What's Missing. Anyway, you're listening to Taste Matters. This is Mitchell Davis. Download the iTunes podcast, listen at heritageradionetwork.com, and be with us next week, Wednesday at 11 o'clock for Taste Matters. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.